I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Dan Engster, and we're talking to Todd May, class of 1941 Memorial Professor of Philosophy at Clemson University. We're discussing his 2019 book, A Decent Life, Morality for the Rest of Us. May specializes in continental philosophy, especially recent French philosophy, but has recently broadened his philosophical focus to tackle some enduring questions in three recent books. He is the author overall of 13 philosophical books and is a consultant for the TV show The Good Place. First of all, Todd May, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Jeff, it's a pleasure to be here.
Todd, I love the book. It's part of a larger project, a kind of trilogy, as it were, of books that you've put out in the last couple years, and it makes a case for The Decent Life. So maybe you could say start first of all for us by saying a little bit about the motivation for the book, and maybe a little bit about its connection to the previous couple books that you've written.
Yes, sure. There are three books, right? A Significant Life, A Fragile Life, and A Decent Life. And what I would like to be able to say is that there's a synoptic vision that holds all these three together. I would like to be able to say that, but I actually can't, because each got actually thought of and conceived individually, and the titles make it sound like there's more continuity than there is. So A Significant Life started just in terms of thinking about what might make life meaningful after reading some work by Susan Wolf, particularly her book Meaning in Life and Why It Matters. When she did it, she thought that she said a meaningful life is one where subjective engagement meets objective worthwhileness. And she left objective worthwhileness open. And I thought, you know, there's something more to say about that. So that book came just out of that. And then the Fragile Life book came out of something I've been thinking about for, I don't know, 40, 50 years. I had a teacher who was a Taoist. And he told me that, look, the universe is basically benign. And I love the idea, but couldn't ever really ratify it. So I wanted to come to terms for myself with what it was, how did I think about suffering and its role in the universe. So that's where that book came around. Right? Now, A Decent Life came around completely differently, which is that I had mentioned to my editor at Chicago Press that I felt like I was out of ideas. I'd written stuff, and I just felt like I was done, and I had nothing more to say. And she emailed me and said, can we talk on the phone, which we rarely do. So we talked on the phone, and she said she was thinking to herself, what book would she like to read that I would write? And she asked me, are you familiar with Peter Singer's work? And I said, of course. And she said, do you know his book, The Most Good You Can Do? And I said, yes, it's about being it's the efficient altruist, right? Being as efficient as possible in giving to others. And she said, I would like you to write that book, but for sane people. Right. And that's how the book, and immediately I knew what she was talking about, right? How do we think about morality if we're not thinking about being the absolute moral saints that some theories recommend to us? And the book actually came together for me fairly quickly after she said it. And so it really was her suggestion that got this third book going.
Yeah, that's great. I thought we could start there with your response to some of the major moral theories that are out there, because part of what you do at the beginning of the book is argue that a lot of moral philosophy, not just Singer's, but a lot of moral philosophy out there is too demanding for the average person. And so you put forward this alternative ideal, that of the decent life. So maybe I thought we could start just by sort of, if you could walk us through some of the over demanding features of moral philosophy in your view, by talking about consequentialism, deontology, and virtue ethics.
Sure. And the rough idea is that there's a question or a couple of questions that these theories are trying to answer. So for Aristotle and virtue ethics, the question is, what is the good life for a human being? And for the consequentialists and the deontologists, it's, well, how should we act? What would be the best way we should act? So in that sense, they're all three looking at superlatives. And for the virtual ethicist, it's what a really flourishing life would look like, a life that, that Aristotle called a life of eudaimonia. Right? And for the Kantian deontologist, it's, well, how can we align our intentions with pure reason? And for the consequentialist, it's how can we act in such a way as to obtain the best results? Right? And if we're looking at things that way, we're looking in terms of superlatives, we're looking in terms of the best and the most. And that's, it's not where I think moral theories go wrong. I think these are really questions worth asking, but I think they leave off the problem that for most of us, our lives are not going to be lived in moral superlatives. And then it raises the question, well, if we're not going to be like that, is there a way of conceiving how we should act in such a way that can frame our moral perspective, give us a little bit of a place to move without holding us constantly to be below the optimal standard?
So along those lines, you know, one of your critiques is that these moralities, or a lot of moral philosophy is too demanding. But there's also a sense in which your arguments sometimes seem to suggest that these are also, or following these moralities in a consistent way, there's something wrong with it or misguided. And that's reflected in part by your editor's, comment about, a book that takes up some of the themes of Peter Singer, but does it in a sane way. And I wonder if that is also what you think, and if that's maybe a double-edged meaning of a decent life. It's not just a life that's less demanding that we can lead, but it's actually a more decent human life. And that the effect of altruists and some of Peter Singer's suggestions, there's something more than human and less than human about them.
Yeah, Dan, I want to be careful about this. It's a really good question. I'm hesitant to say that on a scale of betterness and worseness, right, a life that incorporates moral values and some other values is either better or worse than the life that just incorporates moral values. So I don't want to raise the notion of a decent life above something that, say, Singer would endorse. One of the philosophers that's influenced me a good bit in the Significant Life book and in this book as well is Susan Wolf, who argues that there are lots of different values that don't necessarily resolve into a single scale. And if there are lots of values that don't necessarily resolve into a single scale, then as she puts it in one of her essays, she said it's possible to be perfectly wonderful without being perfectly good. And I think there's wisdom in that. But I don't think it's the kind of wisdom that would say a decent life, as I'm defining it, that instantiates lots of other values, or at least some other values, is better than the life of a moral saint. I think they're different. And my purpose in writing the book was not to say here's a way of living that's even better than what Peter Singer is proposing, but rather here's a way of taking up morality in a way that we won't berate ourselves all the time about it, but we will try to strive to be better morally alongside all the other things that we do. And does that make sense?
Yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe to sort of pick up on this and ask the question maybe in a slightly different way, which is, I was wondering about, the concern that you expressed with consequentialism and its over-demandingness. One way to express the problem is it isn't particularly with its superlative nature that's the problem, but it seems like on your view the problem is that it's a kind of monistic view, that it picks out one particular good and wants to maximize it, whereas it strikes me part of your project is to bring out, I guess, the sort of pluralistic nature of value, and that values are incommensurable, and so a sort of perfection isn't possible in that sense, because there are just many multiple different goods that each conflict with one another.
I think that's possible. This can get complicated quickly, because one could say that there are incommensurable goods which would be, say, a moral goods alongside aesthetic goods, alongside goods of meaningfulness. But one can also say that there may be incommensurable goods even within morality, right? So that some consequentialists think that what one ought to promote is not simply happiness, but, say, happiness and knowledge and beauty, where they won't necessarily be commensurable with one another. So if we look at the field of values, I think we can see that both within morality and across from morality to other fields, there are a variety of values. They can be more or less incommensurable, or at least difficult to translate it, at least the level of value one into another. And it seems to me that what the mistake is not so much that the failure to recognize incommensurable values, because some consequentialists do, but the mistake, it seems to me, is to hold such an absolutist view of the role of moral values relative to others. Susan Wolf gives this case where you have a kid, and I think this is in the text, a kid commits a crime, the police are after him, the kid goes to his mother, and the mother has to decide whether to hide the kid or not. So now she has her love for the kid over and against what her moral obligations to society would be. And Wolf said something that some find disappointing, but I actually find sort of the better part of wisdom. She says, that's a point at which morality ceases to matter for her, because there are other values in play, and those values don't necessarily need to be overridden by the moral values. So I want to accept, Jeff, that it seems to me right that there are incommensurable values both within morality and across, but the worry that I have is less about the incommensurability and more about the presumption of just the straight overridingness of whatever the moral considerations are in every instance.
I guess just a little bit of a follow-up on that. I mean, I guess part of what I thought the move was in the early chapters was they say, look, if we follow out the Kantian ideal or the consequentialist ideal, we're going to not live meaningful lives, right? That morality is going to come at some expense to a meaningful existence. I'm not sure if that's the right way to think about your argument, but just to push that a little bit more. I mean, this is, I think, one way in which your book, The Decent Life, connects back with The Significant Life when you talk about meaning and a meaningful life and so forth. And one of the points I think that you make in the early book is that, you know, a meaningful life is not, you know, disconnected from morality in a way, that in some ways, you know, living a meaningful or significant life can involve some moral striving. Mm-hmm. So maybe you just say a little bit more about the sort of connection between, you know, the meaningfulness of life and the moral demands that are in sometimes opposed to it, but maybe sometimes aligned with it.
Right. And I think that it's that last phrase that I want to really hold on to, right? But it seems to me that a meaningful life can be a life that's morally lived, and it can be a life that is in tension with some morality. So let me say, in order to approach this, maybe say just a bit about the stuff in the meaningful life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the significant life. The idea I was trying to posit there is that one way to think about what would make a life meaningful, an objective value, would be to think of it in terms of what I call narrative values. So some lives have themes of curiosity, others themes of intensity or adventurousness or loyalty. And these lives are characterized by these themes. You can see them, if you watch a person's life closely, you might see that theme across that life. And that theme is, excuse me, not necessarily a moral theme, but it can connect with morality. So you can imagine, for instance, a person whose life is characterized by the narrative value of spirituality, right? Well, spirituality might not necessarily be a moral theme, but in living a spiritual life, there are certainly moral aspects that they're going to take up in accordance with their spirituality. So then that way, well, the narrative value, the value of meaningfulness, and the value of morality may be distinct, you can see moments where they're going to come together. Right? Alternatively, because they're distinct, you can have moments where they're going to come apart. So in the book, I talk about, you imagine the rock star who lives a really intense and fascinating life and is constantly taking up with pushing himself further and further, and yet at the same time maybe leaving bodies in his wake, people who admire him that he uses and then he discards. So I think the relationship between meaning and morality, or between the values of meaningfulness that I'm positing and moral values, is contingent. They can sometimes be seen in the same life and perhaps reinforcing each other, but also they can come apart.
I wanted to ask you in particular about Kant, because I study Kant. So whenever I see Kant in a book, I mean, maybe this is a good example to sort of illustrate your point. Maybe you could just say briefly about, I mean, you have this example about, you know, one of the problems with Kant is that, you know, there's an overridingness of there's the categorical imperative, of course. And, you know, if you make a promise to someone, that promise can't be broken, even if you have to, you know, say step over someone in the street who could use your help, for instance. But you could say a little bit about Kant in particular.
Yeah, and I think Kant is extraordinarily rigid. I think sometimes he's taken it even more rigid than he is.
Yeah.
Because Kant himself distinguished between perfect duties and imperfect duties, right? And the perfect duties were the ones you had to do all the time. You could not ever violate them. So if you make a promise, you have to keep the promise, no matter what, right? You never lie, right? The example sometimes I use is that, you know, my hair was thinning. I mean, when I say it was thinning, I mean it has now fully and completely thinned, right? And when it was starting to thin, I would be, you know, thinking about it, running my hands through my hair, and my wife said, "Oh, don't worry about it. Your hair's fine. Your hair's not thinning." Right now, there are mirrors in my house. I knew my hair was thinning, and I knew my wife was lying to me. But it was the kind of lie that, on the one hand, was helpful. On the other hand, that Kant would never countenance. Right? It was a lie. She doesn't get to tell me this. But on the other hand, Kant has imperfect duties. Right? Duties of benevolence. You don't always have to give everything all the time, but you have to give a certain amount to other folks. So that's not a perfect duty. That's a duty you do sometimes. But at the core of it all is the idea of acting out of duty, out of a sense that this is the thing that has to be done. And I think that becomes the kind of whip that you can put across your own back. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be unhelpful in one, because Kant is such an absolutist about it that he doesn't seem to allow for other values. And he says the only unconditionally and absolutely good thing in the world is a good, morally good will. Right? So you have that on the one hand. But the other hand, and I talk about this in a decent life, I mean, one way that one can live morally, not all the time, but at least sometimes, is to enjoy the good that you're doing for folks. That to think of the good that you do as something that isn't necessarily paying back, but perhaps sort of paying forward out of the stuff that you receive that you feel good about. And Kant, I think, is too deeply committed to the idea of just respecting the moral law for him to recognize some of the things that will actually likely make us more moral because we're feeling gracious in our own morality.
Yeah, he does, of course, have a view of the highest good that incorporates a notion of happiness. But I, instead of going down the route to defending Kant, I wondered if I could, you know, I mean, you could turn the point around. I mean, in a certain way, based on what you just said, which is, I mean, part of Kant's worry, I assume, about your project would be to say something like this, that, you know, by saying something is, you know, morality is over demanding and to lower one, that might lower one's expectations for a person's moral efforts. and may lead to a kind of, you know, one to rationalize away bad behavior, to lead to sort of one giving excuses for oneself. That in other words, it lets sort of self-love drive the car rather. I mean, that's part of why he's an absolutist about morality, is because there's this dialectic of reason that's involved, that of practical reason that's involved, that that leads us to exempt ourselves from the law, as it were. So in any case, I don't know if that's a worry for you, that I guess that general worry, if, you know, is this a kind of lowering of expectations and could that lead to bad consequences?
Yeah, and let me say three things, right? I'll start with the idea that it is a lowering expectations, but I don't think it leads to bad consequences. Because what I'm trying to say is not simply that we ought to lower our expectations, but to give a positive framework for thinking about morality. And that positive framework involves fundamentally recognizing others as having lives to live and being animated by that recognition. So it doesn't prescribe a set of duties or imperatives, but it says, look, we make our way through the world, and as we do, there's other folks out there, right? And those other folks may be irritating to us, but they're trying to live their lives as well, and they have lives to live. And I think some of the characteristics I put out there, you know, they probably fear death. They don't want to be lonely. They want their lives to be meaningful. They want to have decent relationships with other folks, and that idea ought to animate us in a way that isn't simply giving us a set of duties, but also orienting us toward a certain sensitivity toward others, right? It's something that I think a number of feminist theorists have brought into morality, and I think it's made into moral theory, which I think has made moral theory a whole lot more healthy. So I don't want to say it's just lowering expectations. It's adopting a new framework that will have lowered expectations, but isn't defined by it just being Kant-lite or consequentialism-lite. Now, to swing back just to Kant for one second, because as a philosopher, I can't resist this, right? Kant does have a notion of the highest happiness, but his notion of achieving it also requires, right, the belief in an immortal soul and a deity. So it doesn't, it comes with baggage.
Mm-hmm.
So this is probably a good time maybe for you to say a little bit more about what you mean by a decent life. You just said that it's a kind of an animating principle of living with others and recognizing that they have lives to live. But you give examples, especially in chapter 2, that range from things like holding the door open for others or bringing them small gifts to inviting, you know, you tell that you start with the story of Matthew Stevenson, who invites this neo-Nazi to, or I guess a son of a white nationalist, I guess he was being reformed at the time, to Shabbat. And you talk about one of your own experiences where you stop and have this real engagement with a person, a homeless person, where you really stop and you know, kind of try to see who they are. So it seems like there's quite a range just in the second chapter. And then, of course, as you go on in later chapters, it expands out. But is there a way to pin that down a little bit more for us?
I would say this. If the idea is to be able to give an overview of what's common to all these, the answer is going to be no, right? And it's going to be no for a couple of reasons. One is that there'll be cultural differences. The gift giving I mentioned is something that people in Japan do. They, you know, my understanding from folks is that if you don't show up with a gift, that's really bad, right? Whereas, you know, the States, you know, it's going to depend on the context and the friendship and the circumstances and such. So I think it's hard to say, to give a formula for that kind of person-to-person decency, partly because of there's going to be different cultural considerations, right? And I think it's also a matter of we're not, and this is the ratcheting down of expectations. We're not going to do everything, right? I talked to this one homeless person, the next person I may pass them by. Why? Because I'm tired and because I've talked to somebody before. So I think when I talk about a sort of sensitivity, that's what I mean. Not a set of rules that you follow, but a sense of the other people out there. And, a sense perhaps if the person behind the register that you say hello to doesn't smile back, that it may not be right because they've decided to be an asshole or go after you, but simply because they've got difficulties and maybe you can take that into account, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm hesitant to say too much more about how it looks, because I think it's a way of navigating the world more than a framework for a particular set of actions. Now, I'm afraid that what I said is just terribly disappointing. I don't know.
No, it's actually, it's good. And I like what you're doing with this. And I actually would like to also maybe just, since we've been talking a lot about how you're lowering expectations, note that by the end of the book, it seems to me like, although you're perhaps placing morality more within the reach of everyday people and everyday circumstances, you still are asking a fair amount of everyone. And I guess maybe a way is to think of you're laying out a number of imperfect duties for people that you don't have to do all the time in an absolute way, but you should always maybe have on your mind, and you should, you know, if you're, I mean, I think you say at the end, you don't have to give a dollar to the person on the street corner every time, but if you don't, then you should put that dollar away and give it to a homeless shelter, or, you know, things like this. Is that a proper characterization? I mean, it actually seems like you're actually asking a fair amount of people by the end, but not in the Peter Singer-esque like way.
Yeah, I mean, let me say a couple of things about this, right? One is I think you may know that I'm a philosophical consultant for a television show, right? The Good Place.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. That's good.
Yeah, we can come back to that, but Mike Schur, who we've had long talks together now about this stuff, he keeps coming back to one word, and the word is trying. He says, you're often going to fail, but if you keep in mind that you should try, right? That's a way of beginning to grasp it, to grasp the idea that morality should be part of the ethos, right? If not the absolute dictator of what we do, right? But there's something else as well. And when I come to Houston, my grip's going to be on the second thing, which is I mentioned quickly in A Decent Life that there can be times of crisis in which more might be asked of us than would normally be asked. That what would be decent in some circumstances is not necessarily decent in others because of the crisis nature that we might occupy. And I think in a terribly eloquent way, right, Greta Thunberg, yesterday, gave voice to the crisis that we find ourselves in environmentally. And so I think that can up a level of expectation beyond what it would be like for us in other sets of circumstances. So I think there are ways that I think we can push, and I'm hoping that the framework that I lay out will invite people to go a little bit further, right? Not necessarily become moral saints, but be, if I could put it this way, be less a push to go further and more an invitation. And that's why I often try to emphasize some of the positive aspects of morality, how it makes you feel, the kind of gracefulness can allow in moving toward the world, or moving through the world. But I think that there can also be times when it is a burden. It's a burden we must bear, and we have no particular moral choice about that. And those are the situations I call crisis situations.
Yeah, good. I wanted to start working through your chapters, but one of the last things you said makes me think that in a way your project it has a lot in common with Aristotle, particularly the way in which Aristotle has an account of moral action that involves paying attention to context, right? Be doing the right thing at the right place and the right time, and you know, paying attention to character development and the way in which character development is intertwined with the good life. It's not utterly distinct from it. I mean, we haven't talked about virtue ethics really all that much, but I wonder how you think about your own relationship with Aristotle.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention this, because even in the Significant Life book, I have a friend who's here who's he embraces a good bit of virtue ethics. He says, you know, he says, those narrative values you're talking about, he says, all you're doing is broadening Aristotle.
Yeah, right.
I think that's mistaken. That we've had arguments about that, because I think there is a more distinctly moral realm that I think is worth keeping separate from the realm of meaningfulness. Okay, but that's another discussion, right? In terms of the Decent Life book itself, I can see where you want to go with this. I'm hesitant about a couple of things, right? One is the superlative nature of Aristotle. But okay, let's lay that aside a minute. It seems to me that he wants us to cultivate certain virtues, and that cultivating certain virtues will allow us to be sensitive to, you know, say, certain moral saliencies in a situation. But I think the way I want to head is slightly different. Maybe not opposed, but slightly different. And I think it owes more to, as I mentioned, some of the feminist ethics and care ethicists, which is that if we have a sympathy toward others or an empathy toward others, we can cultivate that, right, in order to expand our moral circle. And that idea, which, you know, as you trace back to feminists, you also trace back to Hume, is an idea that I think has less to do with cultivating aspects of ourselves that will then in turn allow us to see the moral saliencies, as going directly to try to see the moral saliencies and then respond to those. And the reason that I like that approach better is that it allows a whole lot more flawed human beings to be in that realm where they can see moral salience. The model Aristotle seems to present is that, you know, you've got to get better and better and better, right, to be able to do the things, right, that situations require, to see what situations require. And my thought is, well, you know, there's a lot of fairly flawed people out there who don't have maybe a lot of, you know, what would be thought of as Aristotelian virtues, but what they're good at is seeing what people need and seeing what people are going through and being able to respond to that. Right? Now, if that's a virtue, you know, that's fine, right? Then we have another Aristotelian virtue, but I don't think it accords with the kind of self-cultivation that seems to motivate a lot of Aristotelian, a lot of what Aristotle is on about in his work.
Yeah, I mean, Aristotle's pretty blunt that most people can't achieve the virtues. I mean, his is an aristocratic ethics. I mean, yours seems like it's like a democratic ethics. That is that, you know, you want to broad, as you say, expanding the circle. And that's indeed the structure of your book, in which you talk about the decency to those close to us, and then expand the circle outwards. What is decency to strangers? And then expand the circle further. What is decency to animals? And then the last chapter is on what is decency to political rivals, which I found kind of funny that political rivals would come after animals, by the by, which we'll come back to that. But maybe we just say a little bit about, just to get us started on this expanding circle idea, how we can think about, you know, decency, a decent life towards our fellows, our friends, our family, in contrast to what the decency towards strangers.
Good. Yeah, and I put those in separate chapters, right? So there are people we come into daily contact with, right? And there are various ways to be decent to them, among which are what's called common decency, right? holding the door for someone, maybe bring a gift under certain circumstances. The one I find intriguing, and some people said this is just bizarre, is the person who leaves the room and then you put like a napkin over their coffee cup to keep it warm, right? Some people thought that was charming. Other people thought it was creepy, right? but in any event, right, those are things you can't do for people who are distant from you, right? You can't just offer them, people just give a smile. And in thinking of people who are distant from you, I said we think of at least two types, right? People who are distant from you in space, but contemporaneous in time, or people who are distant from you in time, right? The people who are going to come, that are going to show up later, right? And so our kinds of behavior toward them is not going to be, I think, always animated in exactly the same way, partly because we don't see them face to face. I think I mentioned in the book, it's really hard to like yell at your kid or even just yell at your colleague, right? If you're actually looking at them in the face, right? I tried to train myself, with my kids when I got angry, just saying, whatever I'm going to do, just look at them, right? When I do it. And it became, it wasn't so easy to get as angry because you could see the humanity of their face there, right? Which is, I think, one reason why we are willing to say things to people on email that we're not willing to say face to face, right? Because we see them. Now, people who are distant in space, you don't see. So that's where this expanding circle comes in. We have to be a little bit more imaginative in recognizing that they've got lives to live as well. Even if we can't see it, even if we can't have that immediate sensitivity to it, right? That they're there. We can read about them. Oftentimes, if people are impoverished, they use faces of people in advertisements to get you to have that, to start that human connection with them. So it has to be slightly different from the people that we're with day to day. And then people who aren't there yet, right? And of course, that's not exactly spoken precisely, because the people who aren't there yet, there are no people who aren't there yet, right? There will be people. But to imagine that there will be people and that those folks are going to be like the folks who are distant, right, involves an imaginative exercise. And then the question is, okay, how can we respond to these people? Not in terms of common decency that you have face to face, not in terms of some of the moral relationships we can have face to face, but in a way that involves, I think I used the term benevolence in the case of people far away. But we can recognize that they have lives lived, and we can perhaps, to the extent that it's reasonable, do something for them.
Yeah, good. So your account of decency, especially towards those who are close to us, is influenced a good deal by care ethics, which we've already sort of mentioned a few times. And I guess I wanted to ask a question about care ethics. This is in part from my ignorance of care ethics. So Dan, who works on care ethics, can also help me here. But I guess one of the questions I had when reading your chapter and when these issues of care ethics came up, that is, that encourages our attention to their relationships and taking cues from our relationships and seeking guidance from them. I guess one of the questions I had was, what if the relationships themselves are very bad, or we're in the relationship that's guiding us in a certain way that we shouldn't be part of it? It's like an immoral, you watch enough of these Netflix shows that have gangs of robbers who are, in these very close relationships, and they seem to care very much for one another. Well, how does a care ethics perspective, or how do you, from your perspective, think about when relationships go wrong? Is there a higher perspective? Does decency guide us, or do we have to go from, a higher perspective, but then isn't that perspective morality?
Well, let me say something, but I'm really interested also to hear what Dan's going to say about this, because Dan has my knowledge of care ethics is spotty, right? I don't have nearly the depth that Dan has on this. So, but, I mean, from my perspective, caring for someone isn't simply ratifying what it is that they do. So you can care for someone, and if they're headed off in the wrong direction, right, part of caring might be that you try to say, look, you're heading off in the wrong direction. and I can't be part of this way that you're going. You know, I care about you, but I'm not gonna participate in you're destroying yourself, or you're helping to destroy other people, right? So part of caring may be cutting off the relationship under certain conditions when you can't actually help the person to, say, get better or to flourish or however you want to think about it, right? There are also issues, and I know Virginia Held is very sensitive to this, that there are issues of justice that can sometimes conflict with the kinds of care you have toward others. And at least in her view, that you can't fold everything or reduce everything to care. There have to be some other values in play that are interacting with care values as well. So I think there's at least two paths open, right? One, the path of caring that sometimes involves kind of confrontation and maybe even cutting off, and also recognizing other values that could come in conflict with caring that you might need to take account of as you move forward. Now, having said that, Dan, I want to toss the ball your way to see what your reaction is, because I'm curious to hear it.
Well, I want to say first, I really appreciated how you talked about care ethics in your book. I thought that I agreed with everything you had to say and very much liked how you talked about the relationship between care and justice. And what you just said, I agree with as well. I would simply add in that care of self also has a prominent role in care ethics. Mm. And this is... this is something that I think is often overlooked, but even as, you know, as far back as Carol Gilligan's, In a Different Voice, you know, her mature voice of care, includes an important consideration for care of self, and also a recognition that when someone is not caring for you, it's no longer a caring relationship. So there are reasons to get out of that relationship, coming from a care ethical perspective, itself, as well as the justice perspective. The Gilligan talks about, you can switch in and out of the care justice perspective, to get different perspectives on where you are in these relationships.
Yeah, I agree. But and I think this is a good point that caring also involves caring for self. I should mention this. I've met and had a couple long discussions with Carol Gilligan. I don't know if we want to stick to philosophy. There is a little story here.
Yeah, go ahead, sure. Please.
Okay. So there is a Danish Institute of Psychology that has annual meetings, and it has anniversary meetings every 5 years. It was 4 years ago, I think, I was at their meeting at Crete, and I was going to give a keynote, and Carol Gilligan was there with her husband, James Gilligan. Carol Gilligan is more well-known than James, but James is, he worked in the prisons in Massachusetts and was extraordinary in cutting down the levels of violence and stuff. He's a real contributor in his own right. So I arrived, I wanted to meet Carol. I wanted to meet James because I was going to speak. I had the keynote the first day and then the keynote the second day. And I had heard that before I had arrived, James had been out in the sea, and he had been pulled under. And fortunately for him, he's going to be like 80, right? He had two people right next to him who pulled him up and he was fine. I think he lost his bathing suit, but basically he was fine. So I meet them. I know this story. I meet them the next day, the morning for breakfast, and I introduce myself to them. And Carol graciously says, "Oh yeah, and I've read some of your stuff. It's really good." And I said, "Well, look. I've taught in a different voice. I don't know how many different times to people. I said it's a remarkable piece of work." And I turn to James, and you know, sometimes you just feel impish. And I looked at him, and I thought, I hope I can get away with this. And I said, "You're James Gilligan, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I hear you give swimming lessons." And there was this moment where I think to myself, either we're going to get along great, or one of the most important feminists in America is going to hate my gut. But you sort of felt like it would work, right? And they looked at me, and they both broke out laughing, right? right? And then we spent 3 hours that night arguing about human nature. And it turns out that, you know, there are a lot of people who don't live up to their theories, right? Carol Gilligan lives up to her theory, right? Very decent, very caring, without being sort of, you know, overly, she's not Pollyannish, right? But you can feel that when you talk to her, she's with you, right? And she was just a delight to be with, as famous as she was. She didn't have an arrogant bone in her body, right? It was just a fun to be with. And I got away with something I probably should not have tried.
That's great. Well, I thought we could turn to, unless you have anything else on Friends or Strangers, I thought we could turn to your chapter on decency to animals.
Yeah.
Maybe just lay out what do you think is decency? What do we owe to animals, or what's a decent life with regard to animals?
Well, if we're going to keep the framework, right, the decent life is going to be recognizing that animals have a life to live, and being sensitive to that, and doing what we can relative to that recognition. And here's a case where things can be very different for different people, not simply because they have different sensitivities, but because they're in different economic circumstances. As I was going through this book, one of the things that my editor was pointing out from an early draft, she said, you know, there's a lot of people out there who actually cannot afford to eat in ways that are going to be, you know, helpful for animals, right? They just, because eating like that's expensive, right? The eating, say, a good diet that is, organic and it stays away from meat, this tends not to be very cheap. So she said, well, you're going to have to think about that, right? And it seems, of course she's right. And so it seems to me that to have a sensitivity won't necessarily prescribe that we become vegetarians, say, right? Or vegans. That we try to ask ourselves, what can we do? So maybe the person, right, who can afford cheap meat but can't afford, say, organic meat, right, can say, maybe I don't need to eat that meat every day, right? I can spend some days where I'm not doing that simply for my health, but for this, for the sake of the animal, right? Whereas those of us who are in more fortunate circumstances, who can buy cage-free eggs, right, and have healthy vegetarian diets and never have to buy anything that's factory farmed, right? Or to think, more seriously about how far we can cut back, right, in order to allow animals to have decent lives. And part of this sensitivity, I think, really comes from recognizing what happens to animals in these factory farms. And there's a reason it's almost impossible to get into factory farms and slaughterhouses, right? They don't want you to see what's going on, because if people see what's going on, it will push them away, right, from participating in that kind of treatment of animals. And what I've said there, of course, goes all the way back to Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, where a lot of people thought, look, it wasn't his arguments, which in some sense weren't terribly good, that was doing the work in that book. It was the pictures, right? People saw that and they were sensitive to it. So if we think, right, if we can form some sensitivity to our animals, recognize they have a life to live, asking what that might ask of us and what we can do, I think that allows us to move forward in a variety of ways depending on our circumstances.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, does that extend to the other circles of decency? That is, that it's sort of indexed to our circumstances, that people who are less privileged and poorer, we should expect less of them, whereas the people who are more better off, we can expect more, say, contributing more to charity and so forth, we should expect more out of more to rich people. Is that, is the ratcheting of expectations there across the board dependent on one's background?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, if I've got an extra buck, right, maybe I should give it to the homeless guy, right? But if the homeless guy has an extra buck, he should not be giving it to me, right? It's, you know, my circumstances are different from his. And so the expectations on me, right, are and ought to be different from the expectations on somebody who doesn't have my level of privilege. And by the way, that also goes, and we haven't talked about politics, that also goes politically as well. We're talking about economic circumstances here. I mean, one of the things that I think it's important to do, if you're like, say, white, like me, right, is to take some time to understand the experiences of African Americans in our society, in such a way as to be able to respond properly to that, right? My editor is African American descent, and she was very helpful in the politics chapter in just talking about the issues involved there and getting me to sort of be more articulate in what kinds of sensitivities I think we ought to have. So it's not simply a matter of economic circumstances dictating what you do, but developing sensitivities around people's particular lives and the particular struggles that they face.
Yeah, that's good. Maybe we could talk about the politics and decency chapter. This is the Political Theory Review, I suppose, so we're obliged to talk about politics. But you have this chapter on politics and decency, which I very much liked, because it's it was a kind of rousing call for decency in an indecent age. But maybe you could say a little bit about your view there. I mean, we live in a country in which we have a lot of polarization, a lot of negative polarization in particular, that is, that the parties are moving further and further apart in their animus against one another. And you have somewhat of a nuanced view here. It's not simply that we ought to be more understanding and open to our rivals, but there's also a point at which our rivals may go beyond the pale, at which point decency maybe mm-hmm. isn't the appropriate response. I mean, I was curious about how to exactly determine where that line is, but maybe you could just start us off and say a little bit about the, you know, how decency should be operative in the political arena.
Good. And let me say, also answer the earlier question we asked about why does it follow animals, right?
Ah, okay, yeah.
because actually it's a very pedestrian thing, which is that up to the chapter on politics, I'm talking mostly about individual actions. And then when I hit politics, I'm focused much more on collective action, right? So that's why I put that toward the end, right? But the chapter that, the orientation of that chapter has a lot to do with my reading and also organizing in nonviolence. And so there's nonviolence is at the heart of that chapter. I've written a book on, I wrote a book on nonviolence some years back, and that was, you know, also behind what I was thinking about. In fact, when I talk about recognizing others as having lives to live early in the Decent Life book, that actually comes from, right, the nonviolence book, where I had my first formulation of that. So it's not that we move when things are, you know, say, overtly racist or sexist, that we move out of decency. It's, I think, a different move. That it's important where one can to try to recognize the other as having a life to live. And in recognizing the other as having a life to live, to recognize that there may be more to that other person than you're seeing, right? An idea that comes up not in the post-politics chapter, actually, that there may be more to them than what's being presented, and sometimes there are ways to reach that so that you're not simply stereotyping them as this person who's believes this and is therefore the enemy. But that has its limits, right? There can be people, right, expressing indecency, right, to such an extent, right? And we, of course, there's numerous examples of this, that we don't, right, that we say, no, we can't countenance that, right? That's not okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to act indecently toward them. What it means is that we might act nonviolently and coercively at the same time toward them. And this is where I think nonviolence becomes really has its bite. That contrary to what Gandhi often thought, which is that all nonviolence works by moral persuasion, that in fact a lot of nonviolence works by putting people in situations that are so uncomfortable for them that they would really rather give up, right, than persist in that situation. So, for instance, during the Salt March, the British soldiers kept beating Gandhi's people and beating these people, and they just kept coming. And at some point, this throws the British soldiers back on themselves to ask, like, who am I really? I can't be doing this. And some of them probably, right, still continue to think of the Indians as inferior, but nevertheless thought, you know, I can't be seen doing this, right? Right. I would like to do it, but I can't be seen doing this. And so it seems to me that you can engage in moral coercion without losing a sense of decency, still recognizing that your adversary has a life to live. And though you're going to try to force them to do things they don't want to do and things that they may even radically object to, that doesn't mean that you are taking them as a being that doesn't have a life to live, that you're cutting off, right, the fundamental relationships with people that they care about and death, and trying to have a meaningful life. So I don't think you have to exit decency, in order to have nonviolent coercion. I think the step to nonviolent coercion is a step away from conversation, right, toward a type of confrontation. But that confrontation takes place on a plane that still recognizes the other as having a life to live.
Yeah, I mean, you could pursue it by, I mean, thinking about the contemporary American context, because I think of this in terms of the way in which the term racist is lobbed around quite frequently today. And it seems like that word has taken on a bigger and broader meaning than it has historically. And I mean, sometimes it's used to paint people as racist who maybe aren't really racist. And I don't know if you just have thoughts about, the way in which the sort of moral persuasion could go better, say, from people on the left towards, say, Trump voters. I mean, you know, what's a better conversation for a Trump voter, say, again, this is, you know, Trump voters, it's not a uniform group, right? But,
right.
Maybe that's the place to start what's a better approach for the left in that kind of conversation?
Let me say a few things about this. So first, directly to the question, right? You know, because Trump voters are a wide variety of folks, right? They're going to be the Trump voters who feel that their racism is just justified by Trump. And I think there's very little to converse about with folks like that. And the folks who showed up to Charlottesville, I don't think we're going to sit across the table and have any kind of productive conversation. But I think there are a lot of Trump voters who are not like that. What concerns me about them is not that they are racist in the sense that these other folks are, right? But rather, right, that they are willing to countenance racism for other things that they think are more important, right? How the economy goes, giving voice to let's say, you know, white middle America that's in the opioid crisis or something like that, right? Then I think there are conversational possibilities because, you know, one can always ask, okay, so what is it that's important about Trump? And if they're not saying, well, because, you know, what's important about Trump is that he recognizes that blacks are inferior and everything they do is terrible, right? Or that immigrants ought to be sent back to their country in shock, but rather saying, look, I think that there have been neglected populations here, you know, and those neglected populations are people he's given voice to. Well, now you can have a conversation, right? Because, right, you might recognize that as well, but now we can talk about the importance of recognize people who are neglected, and maybe that can lead to you're saying, well, look, let's look at lots of different people who have been neglected and marginalized. So there's potential conversational space there, right? But it presumes that you're talking to the kind of person with whom there can be some kind of sharing. Now, having said that, it's surely the case that in this polarization, right, the bulk of the polarization has come from the right. that is from sort of a certain radicalism of the right. But I don't think we need, we can, I don't think we need, I don't think we can leave the left off the hook on this. That, you know, if you look at things from cancel culture to the ways in which we, you know, say toss around the word racist to shutting down speakers, I think none of this is helpful. And I'll give you a contrast case and then say one more thing. The contrast case is, you know, my Yiannopoulos, you know, for whom there was a riot in Berkeley, right? Milo came and spoke at Clemson. And when he came to speak, I was approached because, I was one of the go-to people for doing progressive politics on campus. And they said, what should we do? And I said, let's do nothing. And they said, why? Because he's, you know, he's a part, he's terrible. I said, look, there's nothing that we can gain in a progressive agenda that will involve confronting him. We will give him some voice. He loves having people protest. We won't gain anything by it. Right? There seems to be no point to it. And I actually got a text from someone who was at his talk. And said, Todd, he's talking about you, right? He's insulting you, right? What are you going to do about it? And I said, I'm going to do nothing, right? Because tomorrow he's going to be gone and I'm still going to be here, right, doing my work. So it seems to me that if you see your way forward, getting caught up in these battles and trying to shut down people who speak is entirely unhelpful. He came and went from Clemson. People that are big Clemson fans didn't even know he was there, right? Berkeley was national news, and not in a way that was helpful to the left, right? So I think that the left contributes. And I think this, and this is the last thing, and I'm kind of going on here, but when I was a grad student at Penn State, we did anti-apartheid work. I was one of the leaders of the anti-apartheid group there. And in doing the anti-apartheid work, we had an all-night session with the head of the Black Cultural Center. And at one point he said something, and it's always stayed with me. He said, look, in American society, the best any of us ever get, doesn't matter what color we are, just the best any of us ever get are recovering racists, you know, one day at a time, right? And the more we recognize it in ourselves, the less likely we're going to be just to jump on the other person for it, right? Which doesn't preclude confrontation, doesn't preclude coercion, but does involve a recognition that, look, we're all part of this thing. Right. And I need to deal with it myself and not just think that I stand on this moral plane that's completely qualitatively different from the moral plane of the person I'm confronting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's almost, part of the problem that we face is exactly what you just suggested, is that there's a sense in which when either side, the left and the right, critique the other, it's a sense of, well, there's often a stance of, well, we're morally blameless on one side and the other side is the one who's morally blameworthy. Strikes me that, you know, as you suggest, better strategically and also better for all of us to live better lives is to recognize some kind of common responsibility for problems. I mean, I guess that it points towards I don't know if you've thought about this level of detail, but the use of shaming as a sort of mechanism for political change. Mm. I didn't read much about shame in your book. I mean, which is interesting that, you know, part of encouraging one to a moral life could be through, you know, putting out, you know, honoring those who have lived decent lives. But another way to encourage people morally is by shaming them. And it seems to be quite a bit of shaming that goes on in contemporary culture. So I don't know if you have thought much about shame as a mechanism and what its benefits or drawbacks are.
Yeah, I think there's shame and there's shame. Right? There's shame in which you make a person feel ashamed of what they've done because they've done something egregious and seem to be failing to recognize it. And then there's shame where you go after the basic humanity of a person. And I don't think that those are entirely... I don't think when people act, they keep that distinction alive. Is there a role for shame? Yeah, probably more limited than some people think, but there's a role for shame if somebody's done something egregious and just doesn't seem to want to look at it, right? But the kind of shaming that sometimes goes on is a shaming that's not meant to get a person to look at what they've done, but simply to diminish them. And I don't think it's not that it has no role to play, but I think that has much less of a role to play, right, than people sometimes act as though it were the case. Like, if I just diminish this person, right, then they'll see what they've done and act better. And most of the time, if you diminish a person, they're just going to get resentful and do more of it. So I think there's a role for shame to play. I think that there are, and this is going to lead into contemporary politics, I think that there are people, and very dangerous people, who are immune to shame, right? And unfortunately, I think the current president of the United States is one of them, right? He strikes me as a very classic sociopath that will not and cannot be shamed. He's incapable of shame, partly because he's incapable of having empathy with other human beings. And that seems to me one of those situations that puts you right on the margins, right? So we need to do what we have to do, right, to stop somebody who's incapable of shame and incapable of empathy from enacting programs that are just cruel. And, right, that's, I think, where perhaps the role of shame is not to shame the person, right, because they're not capable. I just don't think Trump's capable of shame, of being shamed, but rather to use shame as a political mobilizer for the people on your side, right, to move them along.
Yeah, let me run this past you, because it's what I've been thinking about with shame, which is, it strikes me when it's effective, what if you're the one doing the shaming of someone else, what you want to do is in some sense try to figure out what the other person respects, or what, you know, a sort of moral model that they expect, you know, if they're Christian, that they're not living up to the exemplar, you know, Jesus as an exemplar or something like that. That maybe part of the problem with shaming is a sort of imposition, maybe a perceived imposition of a kind of abstract moral approach that the other side doesn't respect or doesn't regard or something like that. That much more useful would be to sort of pick out some moral models on the other side and point out the ways in which they're failing to live up. I mean, which I guess points to, you know, I mean, I guess number one, what do you think about that? But number two is, does a decent life invoke moral exemplars or moral models to help live up to?
I think they can be useful, but they can find guidance not in how to be, but in sort of different aspects of our lives. We admire them, so maybe I want to act a little bit more like them, right? But let me come back to shame for just a minute, because I think that we want to keep alive a philosophical distinction between shame and guilt, right? And one way to think about it, the way I think it is helpful, that comes from Bernard Williams, is that guilt is about something you've done, right? And shame is about what you are. And sometimes it's the move can be to make a person feel guilty about what they've done so that they do better. But shame is, and it's proper, you should cut a little more deeply, right? To get people to raise questions about who they are, right? So you stay with the Christian, right? That a person who is, who does something, and you say, wait a minute, that look very Christian what you just did. They can say, yeah, you're right, right? I'm a Christian and I shouldn't have done that. But then a deeper and more painful thing is, wow, if I did that, am I a Christian, right? Am I who I think I am? That's, I think, where shame comes in. And I think there's a role for that, right? But I think sometimes we can cover what might be covered by shame simply through guilt, right, about an act, and not cut deeper. Although that, you know, sometimes, I must say, there's sometimes a role for that deeper cut, right? Now, looking at the other side, right, the moral model, sure, I think that there are people that we admire, that we like to live up to, but what I hope we keep in mind with decency is that we're not moral failures if we don't live up to what these people we admire are doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to conclude by, about with your conclusion where you think, as you mentioned before, you return to the theme of the narrative life or narrativity, and thinking about part of what a decent life involves is being part of a narrative. And this connects up with your previous book on the significant life, which also places a central emphasis on narrativity. And a significant life is a life that's led that has a story. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you sort of in closing is to ask you what I've been thinking about what unifies your books. One of the things that unifies your view, an account of human nature that places that or that thinks of human beings as storytelling or as myth making animals?
Well, it's a great question, Joe. I'd like to avoid giving too much of an account of human nature, right? And for a specific reason, right? That one of the important early influences on my thinking was Michel Foucault. And Foucault was very leery of accounts of human nature, because he thought that much of what is called human nature is actually socially and historically situated and often has political ramifications. So I don't want to say humans are the myth-making animal, humans are the storytelling animal, but I want to say something that I think is a little more, a little less deeply committed than that, which is it seems to me that most human beings, right, as Aristotle, in a great phrase Aristotle uses, the human beings in general and for the most part, right, have the telling of stories as important aspects of their lives. And it can come up in different ways. I bring it up in one way in A Decent Life. I bring it up in another way in A Significant Life, where I say it isn't simply a matter of telling a story, right? Because I talk about Galen Strawson, who denies that his life is a story, denies his life is a narrative, says, no, he lives episodically, but still, in living episodically, embodies a narrative theme, right, that of spontaneity. And so it seems to me that the idea of stories or story themes does play different important roles in different people's lives, but I don't want to use it as a defining feature of human existence. I don't want to make any deep anthropological claims around the role of stories or themes of stories in people's lives.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't ask one question about The Good Place.
Thank you for reminding me, Dad. So, well, what should we ask?
Well, how did you get involved as a consultant for The Good Place, and what is it like? What kind of questions do they come to you with?
Okay, well, I'll give you the quick version because there's a long version as well. it was completely luck. One of the writers, Dan Schofield, was in a bookstore apparently and saw my book and picked it up and read it and said to Mike Scher, the showrunner, he said, you need to read this book. And so I get an email out of the blue from Mike Scher. It says, question from a TV producer. He says, I'm doing the show The Good Place, which I had never heard of. And I read your book in depth, and can we talk on the phone for a little bit? And I'm thinking, well, this could be really interesting. So I said, instead of talking on the phone, why don't we Skype? And we Skyped for like 2 hours, right? It's just one thing led to another, and we were getting along really well. And so then he emailed me a couple more times, and then we Skyped a couple more times. And it became one of those things where we just got used to doing it. I mean, he would sometimes email me with ethical questions, independent of the show, right? And I just thought to myself, I need to get there and talk to the writers. So at one point I said to him, I said, look, I have funds from my university. I can fly out there and spend a day with the writers. And he said, let's do that. And so they said, what themes should we talk about? They want to talk about existentialism. They want to talk about John Rawls, things like that. It was the first time. Then I went back a year later, and this is this past March, and they talked about personal identity issues. They talked about virtue ethics. Or we got into shame-guilt distinctions. And so they have themes that they want to talk about. And then what I do is I present them. And what was great the last time I was there was, I think, because we've been together once before, and so the writers and we were all very comfortable with one another, is they, at one point, they ignored me. And so we're taking my ideas and we're just working on the show, right, where this might go plot-wise. And I became like a fly on the wall watching this creative process. And it was just thrilling to me, right, that to see, oh, I come in with philosophy ideas, and here's where you can take them, here's what you can do, here's what you can build out of them in a television sitcom, right? So they, you know, I've worked with them on that. I've read scripts for the final season, right, because there were some places where they were moving in some subtle philosophical areas and they weren't quite sure what to do. So I sort of helped them try to navigate through those. But all in all, it's been this way of watching really creative people work to take ideas, put them in a different context, bring them alive, and yet not lose the ethical context of it. I mean, to teach these people, right? So those two times I walked into the writer's room with those dozen people was like walking into like the best philosophy class you could ever imagine, with people who are bright and interested and hysterically funny, right? Mm. One of the writers of the show is my daughter's favorite stand-up comedian. Mm. Right? This was great good fortune for me that I did nothing to deserve, but I was surely happy to take advantage of, right? You know it's ending. This will be the last season.
I'm sad to hear that, but I should say I love that show, and so, I mean, it's really one of the best portraits and, you know, of philosophy and invokes philosophical concepts, and it's so well done, so congratulations on that. Have you met any of the stars of the show?
I haven't met the stars of the show, but, you know, because I've been with the writers,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just great good fortune, mm-hmm. On my part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'd say I'm lucky. Oh, and the thing I was going to say is the fourth season is going to have some really interesting moves, both philosophical and non-philosophical.
Okay, I look forward to it.
Yeah, I can't wait. Great. Well, Todd May, thank you so much for joining us on the Political Theory Review.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.